This is the Past Lives podcast, episode 239. I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Past Lives podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We will look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. And please check out for the Past Lives podcast episodes called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. This week I'm talking to Samantha Fay about her book, The Awake Dreamer, A Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Astral Travel, and Mastering the Dreamscape. Samantha co-hosts two popular podcasts, Psychic Teachers and Enlightened Empaths. She's a Reiki master who writes and teaches about dreamwork, crystals, Reiki, healing, and intuition. Hi, Samantha. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called The Awake Dreamer, A Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Astral Travel, and Mastering the Dreamscape. So how did this start out for you, your interest in dreams?
Well, I think I've always had unusual, strange dreams. As a kid, I drove my family crazy in the morning at breakfast time saying, you know, do you want to hear what I dreamt about last night? But I started to notice really in my 20s and my early 30s that the dreams I was having were more precognitive and were starting to come true. And so when I had a series of very important precognitive dreams that led to a life-changing event, I started to pay more attention to my dreams. I started recording them. I would start asking questions before I fell asleep at night to receive more guidance in my dreams. And on my podcast, I started sharing some of my experiences. And oh my goodness, the floodgates opened. And I started getting all these dream experiences from listeners. And I thought, something is really going on here. Now, I do believe that the majority of the time when we sleep and dream, it's just our body's way of releasing stress and coordinating some of the anxiety we might have fallen asleep with. It's just a metaphor, symbolic dreams. But I think a good percentage of the dreams we have, something more is going on where we're recalling past lives. We are given information that will help us on our current path, or we are given precognitive glimpses into the future. And of course, my favorite kind of quote unquote dream is a dream visit with a loved one who's passed away.
Yeah, I think I had one like that. It was something about the dream had a particular quality to it that was different from almost every other dream I've had. I remember it so clearly. And it was so, I don't want to use the word lucid because I don't really know what lucid dreaming is, but it was so clear. And it was just that thing that it just felt different.
Yeah, it's hard to put words to, isn't it? But I always describe it as feeling realer than real.
What it was my mother-in-law came into the dream and she died just about 10 months before. And she looked a lot younger and she looked glowing and she was happy. She didn't really say anything. And I just looked at her and I said, you've just come to tell us you're okay, haven't you? And she nodded and smiled.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And, you know, a lot of people will doubt those experiences and they'll say, oh, that's wishful thinking. But you didn't solicit that. It just came to you. You described the feeling of it being so vivid and realistic, and you instantly knew what she wanted. And the other thing I like to point out is we don't change a whole lot when we cross over. And I think all of us would have this compelling desire to really try and reach back to our loved ones and say, hey, I'm okay and I made it. And often they will come to someone like a son-in-law rather than, you know, their biological loved ones because there's too much grief going on. It's too hard for them to receive that loved one in a dream. But for someone who is just missing them and loving them but doesn't have the intensity of grief, it's much easier for them to impact our dreams.
And do you think for the spirits, for them to come into one of your dreams, for them it's a real, you know, effort. They got to put a lot of energy into it.
Yes, I am told that very, very often in my dreams where I've had loved ones come to me in dreams. I had a very dear friend who came to me a few times in a dream, and they have all said the same thing. This took more energy than I thought, or this is taking a lot of time. So listen carefully. One of my friends, George, who passed away when he was just 27, he came to me in a dream, and I knew by this point in my dreaming world, I knew I wasn't dreaming. I knew we were actually visiting. And I was so excited to see him. And I rushed over to hug him. And he said, no, I haven't learned how to hug yet. And I said, okay. And he patted the bench and he said, just sit next to me and let's catch up. And about 6 months after that, I had another dream and he was waiting for me on that park bench. And he said, I can do it now. I can hug you. I learned how to work with my energy. And I was able to hug him, which was wonderful.
Do you get the impression that there are more advanced spirits, so to speak, who are like teachers, and that he'd gone to see them and they said, well, you've got to do this and you've got to do that?
Yes. I'm told that often, that they have to kind of go to school to learn how to work with their new energy. Because think about it. If these spirits, these people that we love so much on the other side, they've dropped their physical body. So they don't have a vocal box. They don't have skin cells. And so they have to learn over and over again on the other side with the help of their guides, how to work with their energy. I had a client who I was talking to her and I was telling her how her husband is apologizing for scaring her in a dream. And she sat up really straight and she said, well, he should apologize. He scared the crap out of me. I said, what happened? And she said, I woke up in my bed one night and she said, I knew I was dreaming and I saw him coming down the hall and I was so excited. But as he did, his skin kept falling off and it was terrifying. And as she's telling me this, I can hear her husband saying, I'm so sorry. I had to learn how to work with my energy and I will come back in a dream. And he was able to come back in a dream, several dreams, to reunite with her. But yes, they have to learn how to do this. It takes time. It takes them time and it takes us time because we have to be open to it as well.
And as well as having teachers, I suppose, or guides, I think it says in your book that they kind of say they have to get permission from their guides before they can come and visit you.
Yeah, a lot of people might debate me on that, and that's completely fine. But I have been told this so many times in my own dream experiences and in my meditation experiences, that if our loved ones could visit us whenever they want, it would hinder our healing process. You know, we would stay stuck in that grief and we wouldn't be able to move on. And it would keep them stuck in their growing process because they have a lot to do on the other side as well. And so what I have been told is that they have to get permission. There has to be a reason to come through in your dream. They either need to, just like your mother-in-law, let you know they're okay and they made it and, you know, they're looking younger and they're glowing and they're happy and they're doing just fine. Or very often they will come to bring a message, like it's okay to go ahead and move, or it's okay to put the house on the market. Or I had one listener, she was getting married and her future father-in-law passed away about a month before the wedding. And she had a dream where he came to her and said, please go forward with the wedding. You know, this would make me so happy and I will be there. I will be there with all of you. And she woke up and thought, man, that felt like a really real dream, but it's probably just the bride in me, you know, kind of being selfish and wanting this wedding to go forward. But then her future mother-in-law called and said, the weirdest thing happened this morning. I woke up and as I was walking into the kitchen to get my coffee, the wedding photo of, you know, her husband and her fell off the wall. And she said, I think he wants us to go forward with the wedding. So then her future daughter-in-law shared the dream she had with her and they did indeed go forward with the wedding. So very often they will come through because they need to tell you something.
Yeah, it makes me imagine like he didn't get permission and he snuck through because he just wanted to get the message. But I imagine the guides probably would have let him do that one.
Yes, I would think so, because that's important. You know, they care about all those events that are going on in our lives, weddings and births, but even struggles too with job decisions or relationship issues. They still are able to be with us and watch out for us, and often they can intercede on our behalf.
And so can you tell us about a dream you talk about in the book where you were in a subway tunnel with your spirit guide?
Yeah, that was a really quick dream, but the fact that it was a shared dream experience has always stayed with me. I was just walking with my spirit guide and it looked like Penn Station kind of with the, you know, the off-white subway tiles all around us. And I'm just walking through with my guide and I see my good friend and coworker. And she's coming towards me walking with her guide. And I waved and said, hey, and she waved and said hello. And that was really all I remembered from the dream, but it really stayed with me. So in the morning, I get to work and I'm at the copier copying my handouts for my class that day. And I see her and I said, hey, I had the weirdest dream last night and you were in it. And I started telling her about it. And she finished my sentences and finished the dream and said, I had the same exact dream last night. Which really, it makes you think, is our soul leaving our body sometimes when we sleep and visiting these places on the other side?
Yeah, or maybe it's something else, some kind of, I was going to say astral Zoom, you know, or a Skype or something where you're still in your body, but there's some kind of link up some way.
Yeah, exactly. An aspect of our consciousness is zoomed over.
Yeah. And have you heard of this sort of thing happening with other people?
Yes, I have. There have been many, many reports of people who have had shared dream experiences. And it happened to me another time when I was a little kid. I had this recurring dream that I would be, I don't know, I describe it as like a playground for kids, but it was a very specific building. There was a forest, there was a basketball court outside, there was hopscotch and jump ropes, and inside were pinball machines and ping pong tables and all sorts of things. And I would dream of going to this place about once a month until I hit middle school. And they were so real that I never really forgot those dreams. Years later, my oldest daughter was 3 years old at the time, and she met a little friend at a gymnastics class. And the mother and I, you know, when you meet someone and you just feel like you've known them forever?
Yeah.
There was just none of that weirdness of, would you like to do a play date? You know, we just instantly connected and became very, very good friends. And she's still one of my best friends today. And just a few months after meeting her, I never shared my dream experiences, Simon, because I always feel so weird and like I'm going to be judged. But just a few months after meeting her, for some random reason, I brought up these childhood dreams. And once again, she started finishing my sentences and said she had these same dreams when she was a child as well.
And you have dreams, was it when you were younger, that you would dream of glowing beings who visited you at night to bring you comfort?
Yes. And this one, I remember the first time I shared this on the podcast. I don't know if you do this, Simon, after you hit end record, but sometimes I think to myself, Samantha, there is a microphone in front of your mouth and people can hear you. So I was so embarrassed the first time I shared this because it does sound really strange. But yeah, until I was about 9 or 10, I would have these dreams and these beings had no facial features. And I was raised Catholic. They did not have wings. There was no halos. All I can describe them as just these glowing blobs of light. And they would just kind of emerge from the walls of my room. And I never was afraid. Now, I was terrified a lot as a kid because I also saw ghosts and other things growing up. And those scared me. But these glowing beings never scared me. And they would just sit on the edge of my bed and they would tell me things to comfort me. And sometimes they would help me. I mean, I remember one time they would tell me that I had a pop quiz the next day, a math class. There was this boy who just out of nowhere decided to pick on me on the school bus. And it was really bothering me and I couldn't figure it out. And they explained to me that his parents were going through a really hard time and that he was just acting out and had nothing to do with me. So they would just sit at the end of my bed and comfort me. And I wish it would still happen. There's something about that childlike innocence where we're so open to those experiences.
And were those dreams particularly clear, not like what you might call normal dreams?
Yes, exactly. They don't even feel like dreams. They feel more like memories. And that's one thing I try to get across in the book is that there are some dreams that are amazing and vivid, but they tend to be more choppy or we don't remember them in all of its totality. And yet these, I call them soul travel dreams. These soul travel dreams, they're chronological, very vivid, colorful. They make sense. And when you wake up, you remember them. You can't not remember them.
And you say during these soul travels, you remain connected to the body with a silver cord?
Yes. And this is something that has been taught throughout the centuries by many, many different religions and beliefs. It's not unique to Western or Eastern. You can find this belief in a silver cord everywhere you look in esoteric knowledge. And so it really came to light with astral travelers and people who are able to consciously astral travel, like Robert Monroe or Solvay Modun, for example. And they will often describe when they leave their body, seeing their soul connected to their body by a silver cord. Now, some people say that silver cord is right where our actual physical umbilical cord used to be when we were connected to our mothers. But others, like Solvay Modun, say it's actually in the back of our neck, at the base of the brain. So I'm not really sure, you know, where that cord is or if we have more than one cord. But it is said to connect us to our body until we take our last breath. But there are people who can unconsciously astral travel, meaning they astral travel in their dream state. And many of them will report seeing this silver cord as they come back to their body. And I wonder if that what could explain the hypnagogic jerk. Have you ever had that experience where you're falling asleep and then you jerk awake? And maybe you've been dreaming about falling or tripping or skateboarding down a hill, and then you just jerk awake.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's our soul kind of slamming back into our body too fast.
Would you say astral travel and soul traveling are the same thing, or are they subtly different?
Well, I call it unconscious astral travel because I think what's happening for a lot of these people like me who have these experiences on a fairly regular basis in their dream state, I do believe we are astral traveling. I just don't think we're doing it at a conscious level the way, say, a Robert Monroe did, where you're wide awake and you're sitting in a chair and you meditate yourself into this vibration where you can consciously project your soul elsewhere. I think there are many people out there who do this unconsciously while they sleep. And you can call it astral travel. I prefer to call it soul travel because it is done at an unconscious level. But I do think that I didn't call it soul travel forever. I used to call it night workers because there are so many of us who report these dreams where we're crossing over earth bounds or giving counseling advice to others or doing healing work. And so I do think that there's an aspect of us, and I think anyone can do this, and many more do than they might even realize. One, we are sleeping, we are traveling, and you can call it astral travel because it is in our astral body.
And you talk about premonitions in dreams in the book, and this was fascinating to me. One of the things you point out is that it seems that most of them are to do with like bad things happening, and it's never so often a premonition of something great.
Yeah, I think that tends to be true for the most part. I have had premonition dreams of really good things. I had a premonition dream, shortly before I met my former husband. I had a premonition dream. Dr. Ian Stevenson calls them announcing dreams before I was pregnant with one of my children. So I do think you can have positive premonition dreams, but I think the reason why so many of them are negative is because, and just bear with me here, I really think that everyone is intuitive. And I think it's an innate ability that we had to develop before we even became civilized to keep us safe, right? So we had to be able to have, you know, like eyes in the back of our head to sense a predator coming. We had to be able to communicate with others. We had to be able to pick up on any danger in our surroundings. And so I think the reason why a lot of premonitory dreams can be negative is because it harkens back to that flight or fight defense mechanism we have built into us. And so we might pick up on the heaviness of that. Also, anything negative coming does have kind of a denser, heavier energy, and that's going to be much more easy for an untrained intuitive to read and pick up on. But the reports of premonition dreams are absolutely fascinating. I could have done 3 volumes of an entire book rather than just a chapter or two on the history of premonition dreams that exist. And they include many famous people. Mark Twain had a famous premonition dream where he dreamt that his brother, who was working on a steamship several miles, 100 miles away, he had a dream that he died and saw his entire funeral. And then, of course, unfortunately, it came to pass just a few weeks later. And Mark Twain had already written about this to his sister, so it's very well recorded that he had that dream.
Hello, Simon here. Every week I produce an extended episode of Past Lives Podcast, and these episodes can be 20 or 30 minutes longer than the 1 hour episodes. They contain amazing information from the guests. For just $5 a month, you can get access to the back catalogue of Past Lives Podcast extended episodes, as well as the weekly extended episodes. It's easy to sign up at patreon.com/pastlivespodcast. The extended episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. The link is in the show notes. And do you feel that these dreams are given to us by our guides or a higher self, or they're more spontaneous?
You know, I'm not really sure. I've thought about that a lot, and I wonder if some of these premonition dreams could be given to us by our guides to kind of give us a heads up and prepare us. But I also wonder if time isn't as linear as we think, and maybe we just kind of dip and weave into different timelines when we're sleeping and our defenses are down. I don't know. What do you think?
I sometimes feel like it doesn't make sense as to why this person or that person would have a premonition dream. I read about a woman who had dreamt of 9/11 before it happened, and she was miles away. It had no like physical effect on her or her family or anybody she knew. So it seemed like, why would she have that premonition? But then other people might have a premonition and it directly affects them. And so it seems a bit weird that that lady would pick that up.
No, I agree. And what I talk about in the book are the Princeton egg experiences, where they put these random computer generators all around the world to kind of pick up on the collective unconscious, the energy going on around the world. And they noticed that these random number generators would spike before major events like 9/11 or Princess Diana's death, for example. And so there is this belief that there are certain people who are naturally intuitive and open to this, who can tune into these events before they happen. There is something that comes with these premonition dreams, though, that is called, it's called a little bit of guilt. I don't want to call it survivor's guilt, because that woman wasn't even near the towers. But a lot of people will have these dream experiences of something negative coming, and yet, you know, you're not able to stop it. The man I write about in the book who started the Premonitions Bureau in England, where he in the 1960s was trying to record all of these premonition dreams being sent into him. This one man was able to give such accurate information on an airplane that was going to crash, and he called the airlines and everything. And he, of course, nobody listened, and it happened, and he felt so much guilt. But I don't think we should feel guilty. I think these are just indicators of people with natural intuitive abilities. And I think if we all tried to tap that ability a little bit more through meditation and, you know, a critical thinking, but also an open mind, we too could have those experiences for ourselves.
I wonder if you rung up the authorities and said you think there's going to be a plane crash tomorrow and then it happens, they're more likely to think, uh-oh, what have you got to do with it? How come you might, they might think you're a terrorist or something.
Exactly. These days, that would be a hard phone call to make. But if you look at the research, there were people all over the world who had dreams of 9/11. There have been, you can Google children's drawings before 9/11. There were so many children who were drawing images of the towers. It kind of looked like the tower card from the Tarot with, you know, fire coming out of it. And so I think when these big events are coming, a lot of people can tune into it, which is why when you ask, you know, is this indicative of our guides telling us of something that's coming? I really grapple with that, because I do think some things in our life are destined, fated, if you will. But I do think that most of the events in our life are up to our free will. And it's really tricky trying to decide which is which. But usually when something is destined, it's going to happen no matter what you do. Very often you will have a premonition dream about it. And it does serve as a warning to kind of get your ducks in order and know that, you know, you're not alone through that situation. So, for example, one of the events I mentioned in the book, at the time that I had these series of premonition dreams, I was married to a police sergeant, and I had this recurring dream over and over and over of an image of someone getting shot in the neck. And I didn't see a face. I think myself would not allow me to see his face. I just saw the bullet hitting the neck. And it was so terrifying. And I remember, you know, telling my, this, you know, something bad's going to happen at work, and you've got to wear your bulletproof vest, and you've got to wear your Archangel Michael medallion that we had blessed. And he just kind of, you know how tough guys are. Oh, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. And I remember when he was shot in the neck, and I went to the hospital with my sisters and my best friends, and we were all waiting. The first responder was an EMT man named Jason, who was just a hero in every sense of the word. He never left my side for 24 hours. He just never left my side. He explained everything that happened. And he said to me, "Samantha, I almost feel like this was meant to be." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, when the call," he said, "we got a fake call to that address or to that neighborhood. And we went to the first address we were called out to, and nobody was there. And we just thought it was a prank call. And so we were just sitting in the ambulance, kind of, you know, writing up the report. No one was home when we got the call of Mike's shooting." And he said, "And if we weren't there at that exact moment, he wouldn't have made it." And as soon as he says that to me, a nurse comes down the hall and she starts telling me about all these miracles that occurred in the OR that night, how he kept coding, but he kept, you know, fighting, and he needed blood transfusions. And she said, "Normally we have to go down, I guess, into the basement and get the blood." And she said, "It takes a lot of time." And he did not have that time. And she said, "I don't know how or why, but the exact amount of blood and the blood type we needed for him was right there." So all these things, I could go on and on, but I won't. But all these things lined up that made me feel like, for some reason beyond our comprehension right now, that terrible event was part of his and our family's destiny.
It's like that idea that before you're born, you work out a life plan, and that might have been part of the plan.
Yes, exactly. And so many lessons, you know, can come through those difficult times. And that's something I'm always trying to emphasize. When we're given a gift of a dream, or just when we take time to look at our life through different lens, we can see that even in the darkest times, we're not alone. And there really is a rhyme and a reason and a purpose to so many of those difficult times, as much as they are awful to go through and as terrible and scary and fearful as they are. When you look back at it, you can see, oh my gosh, my soul has grown so much. I'm so much stronger. Or I learned about faith, or I learned about the power of showing up, or I learned how to rely on people. I learned, you can go on and on about the lessons that are learned. And I think really that's what this is. Earth is a school. We're not here to have fun and, you know, hang out at Disney World.
If we can get to something positive then, a happy dream premonition in a way, as you talk about how somebody was told where to find a stone jar filled with gold.
Yes. Okay. That was such a neat one. That was an old one from, I love looking at like older research and newer research just to show the timelessness of these concepts that we call new, because they're really, really not. So this woman she lived in her grandfather's house, and she had heard all these rumors that her grandfather had found gold and buried it in the house. And the two generations before her, they had searched the house for gold. They did not find any. One night she has a dream. Her grandfather comes to her and he shows her where it is. It's hidden behind a wall they had built up to put in this brand new kitchen in this old farmhouse. And she trusted that dream, and they took that wall down. And sure enough, in the old oven buried behind that wall, they found the gold. I have another story in there about a woman who was widowed suddenly and was told that her husband, there was no money in the bank. And she said, no, this, I think this was in the 1920s. And she said, no, I know he had at least $5,000 in that bank. And they said, well, I'm sorry, it's not here. So she had to sell the house and move in with her daughter and her daughter's husband. And, you know, no one was happy about that. So she was really worried about her situation. She had a dream one night where her husband came to her and said, I took the cash out and I buried it in this tree, underneath this tree and behind our old house. And so she scraped up enough money to get on the train, go to her old house, dug right where he told her to, and she found all the cash.
So I wanted to ask about soul travel dreams in which you were a student in a type of astral psychic school, and there was a dark mass that came in.
Yeah, these were some of my favorite dream experiences, and I don't have them as much anymore, and I really wish I did. But when I was taking a lot of intuitive development classes in my daily life and learning about crystals and Reiki and all sorts of wonderful healing tools, at night, I would have these dreams where I was in class, and it was like this heavenly school on the other side is how I describe it. The interesting thing is that I saw the same people in class every single dream experience, the same way you would if you were, you know, going to your local university. But this one dream in particular, we were learning how to work with dark negative energy. And so the teacher was telling us, you know, okay, this dark, scary thing is going to come at you, and we want you to learn how to deal with it. And we weren't given a whole lot of instruction. So I just remember we were all standing on this, like a fourth or fifth stairway landing in the hallway. And this hideous mass of dark energy that was like growling comes up the stairs trying to attack us. And the teacher's standing behind all of us, and she's yelling, remember your light, remember your light. And so we all reached into our heart chakras and just pulled out these balls of light, and we threw it at this terrifying dark mass of negative energy. And I thought it would kill it. I thought that's what the lesson was, but it didn't. All of our balls of light infiltrated this dark mass of growling, angry, negative energy until it transformed into a glowing being of light. And it was such an instructive, quote unquote, dream for me, because I realized there really isn't anything that is light or dark. We are all both. And it's just what we choose to grow inside of us. And so it's not about, you know, killing the ego or killing the shadow. It's about just transforming it with light and love.
And another dream you talk about in the book that I think was quite instructive was something about how you saw a short, kind man and you're at the Tree of Life. And he said, oh, yeah, there's a secret door at the back.
Oh, yes. I'm so mad at myself for this dream. Yeah, I had this dream that I was walking and I saw what I can only describe and only believe to be the Tree of Life. It kind of reminded me, if anyone's been to Animal Kingdom in Disney World, they have a replica of the Tree of Life. It kind of looked like that, but way, way, way bigger. And so as I'm approaching it, I realize what I'm approaching and I get very nervous and scared and in awe. And this little short man, old man, comes up to me and he says, do you want to find a secret way to get into the Tree of Life? Much easier. And I was like, heck yeah. Because at the time during my daily life, I was being told, you know, oh, you have to meditate every single day and you have to do this, this, and this. And I didn't want to do all of that. And I remember in the dream thinking, I knew there was a shortcut to all this esoteric wisdom. I knew it. So he takes me behind the Tree of Life and he's pushing away some greenery. And then he stops and he says, no. If you think there's a shortcut to the Tree of Life, you're not ready. And I woke up. So I was still so mad at myself. I wish I could have just said, no, I'm ready to go through the hurdles and challenges to go through the front door of that Tree of Life, but apparently not.
And do you feel that was one of your spirit guides?
I don't know if he's one of my spirit guides. He felt like a guardian or protector of that Tree of Life. He felt older than old, you know, just incredibly wise and almost not human, but he definitely was human, but he just felt so ancient and wise. And there was a kindness to him, but a sternness as well, like a very much he was going to put me in my place. And he did.
He had that aura about him of, I'm the guy in charge.
Yes. Yeah. And there's no shortcuts to this to this thing called life, right?
Yeah, and learning the stuff that you were learning with the Reiki and all these crystals and things, it really takes time, doesn't it? It's not like you can just do 3 or 4 lessons and you got it and you get your certificate.
No, and I think we, especially here in America, we think everything should be instantaneous. You know, we get mad if we wait more than 5 minutes in a fast food line. And so we have this belief that everything should be super, super fast. I said on my podcast just a couple of weeks ago, I said, I want everyone to realize when they try meditating to connect within, 90 to 95% of the time, nothing happens except you just enjoy sitting in silence for 10, 20 minutes. I didn't think anything of that sentence. I can't tell you the emails I've gotten from people saying, thank you so much for pointing out that so much of the time when we're trying to work and grow and evolve our soul, nothing happens. Because I feel like a lot of people do say, oh, if you just meditate, everything will open up. Or, oh, if you just ask to meet your guide in a dream, you'll have one that night. None of that is true. It takes a lot of time and effort and consistency, work and devotion and dedication. And I think we have to remember always our reason. You know, what is our reason for trying to have these dream experiences? Or what is our reason for trying to remember our past lives? Or what is the reason that we want to meditate? It's not to have these amazing, cool Tree of Life dream experiences. To me, it's really just about learning how to evolve and grow our soul and to be of service to the light.
I think there's a lot of people who want to do astral travel and kind of feel that you can get that quite quickly, but I think that takes a lot of time to work out how to do it.
Yes, it really, really does. I'm the first book I read on astral travel was, of course, Robert Monroe's. And for him, it did happen so instantaneously that he didn't even want it to happen. But then I started reading a lot of older books by well-known astral travelers. Oliver Fox, for example, one of my favorite books on astral travel. Very, very humorous, funny Englishman. And I just really resonated with everything he said. And he said it took him 7 years of consistently trying to just have a lucid dream before he could astral travel. Now, he ties lucid dreaming with astral travel. He says, once you can learn to become awake and aware in your dreams, then it's much easier to consciously project your soul out of the body. Isn't that interesting?
It reminds me of Buddhist monks in a way, because they're completely dedicated to what they do. And it takes them years and years and years to do the daily meditation and things, but they don't reach enlightenment. So it's like they do it their whole lives and they still don't get there.
I know. And, you know, as a Catholic, though, I have to say, like, I grew up not reading so much about Buddhist monks, but reading about, you know, Jesuit monks and saints and all these hermits and these amazing visionaries. And I was like, gosh, they have these wonderful, amazing experiences. I really need to meditate. But we have to learn how to live in this life and be of this world. It's very tricky. I mean, Simon, if you and I just went and sat on a mountain for 30 days with nobody bothering us, no bills to pay, no kids to feed, no dogs to walk, we'd have a really cool experience, right? We would get enlightened or have a vision quest or something, but we have to live in this world. And I think that's the challenge for so many people who are on this seeker's path. And one of the stories I tell in the book is how when I started meditating, I had 3 kids in 4 years. So my kids were very, very little. I had 3 little kids. I had 2 dogs, 2 cats, a hedgehog, 2 hamsters. I had a lot going on, right? I had no time to meditate. And I didn't even have a place to meditate because my house was covered by dog toys and cat scratching posts and Legos and Barbies. And so I turned my walk-in closet into my meditation space. And I used to joke, why not? I'm already living in the metaphorical closet as an intuitive. I might as well sit in there and meditate too. And I put a little pillow in my walk-in closet and I would bring the baby monitor in. And whenever my kids took a nap during the afternoon, whether they slept for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, that's when I would meditate. And it really took that that level of dedication to get anywhere with not only my dream experiences, but also my waking life spiritual experiences. But it's hard. It's not easy.
You had dreams about counseling people at an Oceanside cafe. Was that right?
Yeah, I still have these. I have them frequently where I'm sitting at this little cafe. The ocean is just behind us. Sometimes I'm just walking down the ocean with someone, and I'm very often just counseling them or listening to them. Sometimes I'm reading cards for them. Mainly I'm just holding space for them. And I've had these dreams for a really, really long time. And my father passed away, unfortunately, this May, but after suffering a really long battle with Alzheimer's. And when he started slipping into dementia, I started having these dreams where I was talking to him. And they were so wonderful because it was just like the old days when we could talk about politics and religion. And my dad's the one who really exposed me to all these unsolved, mysterious questions. You know, who are we? Why are we here? Who's overseeing us? And in these dreams, I would have those experiences. And then I would have these other dreams where I was just giving readings or healing or listening to people. And again, I started sharing those on my podcast. And I never said, like, oh, in this dream, I'm sitting at this wrought iron white table with the ocean behind me. I didn't get that specific. I didn't want to bore listeners. And I started getting emails from listeners saying, this is going to sound really weird, but I think I met you in one of those dreams. And we were sitting at this little, like, I don't know, like a coffee shop or a cafe, and the ocean was behind you. And, you know, the first one, you're like, okay. But after the 12th, the 15th, the 20th, you think something has to be going on here.
It's like you say the soul traveling or the astral travel or there's some kind of meetup. But it's not like, I don't know, you got a clipboard and you're writing a list down and, oh, this person's going to be here at 3 o'clock. Right. And then it's spontaneous, isn't it?
Right. It's very spontaneous. And it's really incredibly real. I mean, there are so many dreams where I'll be talking and I'll hear an alarm and I'll feel a tug in my solar plexus chakra, right in the center of my torso. And I'll say to the person, oops, I gotta go. And it's like, I can see and feel myself being pulled like through this vortex back into my body. And I wake up and my alarm is going off. And when I have those dreams, and now this could just be, I don't know, you know, my mind making this up, but when I have these dreams, I do wake up more tired than I went to bed. And I've heard that from many, many other people who have these dream experiences too, that when they wake up, they don't feel as rested, they're tired, and yet they can't shake the vividness, the reality of that dream.
Did you have at that Oceanside Cafe, your mother was there? Was that right?
Yeah. So I have this very interesting relationship with my mom. She's a little bit of a narcissist. And I always grapple with that. You know, it's very, very hard, I think, to be raised with a mother who does not believe in unconditional love. And so it's just a struggle I've carried my whole life. And I had this dream where I was at my Oceanside Cafe and she was holding my hands, which my mom does not hold hands. I don't think she's ever hugged us. You know, she's just not a touchy-feely person. But in this dream, she's holding my hands. And she felt so warm and so loving. And I was kind of, in the dream, I was kind of jarred, like, okay, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop, like, what's coming now? And she said, how is this going for you, Samantha? And I said, it's going fine. And she said, well, when you asked me to incarnate into this life, to be a thorn in your side, you know, to be, I think she used an expletive word that starts with a B. She said, I agreed because I knew it would help you so much. But I have to tell you, it is so hard being this mean all the time. And I squeezed her hands and I said, I know, but it's helping more than you can know. And I really, really appreciate it. I really did not know what to make of that dream. At the time, I was seeing a wonderful therapist to help me with my mom issues. She's, you know, obviously getting elderly. And so it's very hard taking care of her with some of her flip-flopping behavior. And he described it as a dream expressing my desire for mother love. And, you know, maybe he's right, but it, I don't know, Simon, it felt really, really real. And it was at that same place where I'd been visiting with my father while he was dealing with dementia. And it just makes you wonder, do some of the difficult people in our lives, do they incarnate to be difficult to help us? Are they not just beautiful souls at their core? And we just can't see it in this lifetime.
That's that kind of Michael Newton model of between lives, isn't it? That you have your soul group and you sit down and you choose your next life and what your lesson's going to be. And somebody in your soul group might say, okay, I'll be your horrible mother for the next life. And you go, hey, great. Yeah, thanks a lot.
I know. And it's hard. It's hard to really think about that, isn't it? But I don't know. It makes sense when you reflect on it. I love Michael Newton's work, but the only thing I don't like that he says is he does not believe in angels.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he says, I said either in his first or his second book, but I love his writings and what his research has revealed. But I do believe in angels. I do believe that we have so many helpers on the other side that aren't just our people who have gone before us.
I suppose it could come down to definitions and what you define an angel is. And if they're just, you know, some kind of spiritual being that is not having lives on earth, but is doing tremendous work to help all the souls. And Michael Newton might agree to that. And then you say, that's an angel. And he'll go, oh, no, that's not an angel.
It's all just labels, right?
Yeah. This sort of kind of leads us on to reincarnation. And in the book, you talk about past life dreams. Do you feel that a lot of these are authentically past lives?
I do think they are because of the changes that occur in the person's life after they've had a past life dream recall experience. One of the most profound ones that I talk about in the book is a friend of mine who was not able to conceive naturally, and they had gone through several rounds of IVF. And, you know, that's expensive, it's time consuming, and it's incredibly hard on the woman with all the hormones and everything. And so she was very, very sad about it and really just praying about it all the time. You know, what can I do? And she went to bed one night and she had this dream where she recalled that she was a concubine in a past life, just kind of kept in this room, this elaborate room of this palace. And every time she would get pregnant and have a child, the emperor's people would take the baby from her. And she woke up from that dream. And I remember her saying, I had all the emotions of that woman. Like, I felt the loss of all those babies. And she thought, I wonder if subconsciously I'm preventing a pregnancy so that I won't have to go through that grief and that loss again. You know, if there's any doctors or scientists out there listening, please don't roll your eyes. I know there's physical genetic reasons and all of that why people can't or do get pregnant, but she had this thought and she decided to just really send prayers to that woman in the dream, you know, believing it was her in a past life. And she signed up for the next round of IVF, but before they could get there, they got pregnant naturally. And it just makes you think, like, how does that work?
Yeah, I know. I take people through past life regressions and things like that come up. And sometimes before we start the session, people will say to me, I had a past life dream. And then we'll go to that past life during the hypnosis and I'll get a lot more detail out of it.
Yes. And I think past life regressions can help in so many ways with dreams. You know, I talk in the book about how my sister, as a kid, had a series of nightmares that terrified her. And the worst part about these nightmares was she couldn't remember them. She would just wake up screaming. I mean, one time my mom tells a story when she was five, she ran out of the house screaming. And so it scared my parents. You know, they had to work on bolting the doors better. And then my dad got really into all this esoteric stuff when I was a little girl. And he decided to do a past life regression, a guided past life regression on my sister and myself. And it enabled my sister to have a dream where she recalled the past life that was initiating all those nightmares. And she remembered it all. And she never had a nightmare again. And it was about how she was a little girl. She was a slave in the South. And she was She was sweeping and she had broken, I think, a chandelier. And instead of the owner of the house beating her, they had her mother, who worked in the kitchen, do it. It was just terrifying and traumatic and awful. And just recalling that helped her so much. So I think very often the two can go hand in hand.
And you had a dream which sounded like a bit of a nightmare. You talk about there was a group of people who took it in turns to show you how they died.
Yes. No, it wasn't a nightmare. It really felt like such an honor. I loved this dream experience. I woke up in my bed, and this happens often when we are lucid dreaming, where you'll wake up and you realize you've woken up in a dream. And very often in these lucid dreaming experiences, you're somewhere familiar. So I woke up in my bed. I knew I was dreaming, but I knew I was awake. And this very kindly, grandfatherly looking gentleman, he was wearing jeans and a denim shirt and a red baseball cap and had that weathered, wrinkly skin. And he was sitting on the edge of my bed, and he said, "Hey there, darling, how are you?" And I just kind of nodded. I couldn't speak in the dream. And he said, I'm Red. He said, "There's a couple of people in the kitchen who want to see you. Do you mind?" And I shook my head no. And I went into the kitchen, and my kitchen was filled with all these people. And he said, "Go in, darling. They just want to shake your hand." And the minute I shook each of their hands, I was with them in their last moments on earth. I remember the first woman, I shook her hand, and I was seated with her in a Honda hatchback, and she was in a nurse's uniform, and she was looking in the rearview mirror and putting on chapstick, and you know, just a normal day. And she was sitting in the driver's seat, and she reached into the back seat to grab her bag, and she clutched her heart and fell out of the car. And I witnessed that with her, and then instantly I'm back in the kitchen, and I remember her smiling and saying, "It was a Monday when I died." And then I went over to every other person in the kitchen and witnessed their moments. And upon reflection, I realized they had all died suddenly and quickly. Not necessarily, there was one car accident, but most were heart attacks or brain aneurysms in their sleep, like very sudden passings. And after I had witnessed their last moments, Red just led me back to my room. And I remember he tucked me into bed and pulled the covers under my chin and patted my hand. And he said, "Now, was that so scary?" And I shook my head no. And he said, "We've been trying to come to you this way for years." He said, "But you're so scared of your abilities. And finally, I came up with this idea. It's not so scary in a dream, is it?" And again, I shook my head no. And he said, "Good. You did good tonight." And then I woke up for real. And so I guess that could sound like a nightmare, but to me, it felt like such an honor to be able to witness their last moments. And I got the feeling that these people kind of had a foot in both worlds, like they hadn't fully crossed over to the other side, because they needed that witness to the shock of their final moments on earth. You know, I think we're all like that. Do you ever have something like really awful or really great happen to you, and your first instinct is to share it with someone, right? You got to call your friend. "You're not going to believe what my boss said to me today." Or, you know, if you win $50 in a scratch off, you got to call your friend and share it. And I felt like they just needed to have someone validate and witness this before they could fully accept it.
So can you tell us about your podcast?
Sure. So I have two podcasts. One is called Psychic Teachers, and the other one is called Enlightened Empaths. My dear friend Deb and I started Psychic Teachers, 13 or 14 years ago, a long time ago. We were really, really into intuitive things, but we were both college teachers and firmly in the psychic closet, right? We didn't want our coworkers to know what we were talking about. And we just wanted to find a way to connect with like-minded people, you know, people who were grounded and practical and living in the here and now and, you know, walking the dog and paying their bills and doing all the normal stuff, but also interested in learning about this wonderful world of intuition. And I live in the Bible Belt, so we were like, we're not going to find it here. So we decided to start the podcast, and it's done exactly that. You know, we've been able to really work with and learn and grow with our listeners. And so that's been great. And we talk about everything from determining your psychic super strength and learning about the different clairabilities and chakras to talking about magic and unsolved mysteries and mystics. And then my show Enlightened Empaths with my friend Denise Carell is more about how to recognize and honor your sensitive nature. You know, if you are an empath, are you more susceptible to energy vampires? Do you need to work on setting boundaries? How can you practice self-care? And so we have more of an approach about working on the self on that one. And I really love doing both.
And the book we've been talking about is called The Awake Dreamer, A Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Astral Travel, and Mastering the Dreamscape. And I'll put links to everything in the show notes. Do you have plans for other books?
Yes, I'm working on my next book. I'm doing the research right now. It's about what happens when we die. But what I'm focusing on is looking at what all of the religions throughout the world, throughout the ages, say about the afterlife. And then I'm going to compare and contrast it with what near-death experiencers and researchers say. So it's so far, it's been super fun to research.
Yeah, it's that idea that maybe the ideas of heaven and hell came out thousands of years ago because people had near-death experiences and talked about what happened to them.
Yeah, and they didn't need to have names for them. I mean, Plato talked about a soldier named L. I think it's just E-L who died. And they instantly were just, you know, going to bury him because that's what she did back then before embalming. And he woke up and talked about his visits and travels to the other side. They didn't have a name for it, but it's still been recorded that long ago throughout all of this wonderful history we've been able to live and research and study. And I find that absolutely intriguing.
Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for coming on my show. And I just want to say that I really, really love both your podcasts. You have such a great way of interviewing and sharing research, and just keep up the great work.
And I had a great time when we recorded that podcast episode because it was so easy to talk to you guys, and the questions you asked were just, it was just like a conversation, really, wasn't it? It wasn't like it was question answer thing.
Yeah. That's how we try to keep it. Just chatty and fun, but also informative. You were a great guest. I hope you come back on.
Yeah, I will definitely. Okay. Thanks a lot again.
Thank you.
And that was an interview with Samantha Fay about her book, The Awake Dreamer, A Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Astral Travel, and Mastering the Dreamscape. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And the Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast. And I release new episodes every Monday. And you can find it on almost every podcast app. And I've also added a new tier to the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign, where for $12.50 a month, you can get the Alien UFO Podcast extended episodes every week, as well as the Past Lives Podcast extended episodes. And including the Alien UFO podcast episodes, there are now more than 100 extended episodes available in the back catalogue. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the links are in the show notes. And look out for the Past Lives podcast episodes called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. And there is a Past Lives podcast Facebook group. If you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.